Thank you so much. And all of us who saw Damian in the past session, previous session, will definitely want to join Altria in that reception, I think. We have a panel of remarkable people here. I think they need no introduction to the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival. And nevertheless, I'm going to say one thing about each. Michael Kahn of the American Shakespeare Company and also of the Juilliard School, and a welcome face here in Aspen. Dana Gioia, I hope you've had a chance in the past few days to see any of his remarkable presentations on reading and poetry and art and life and really tremendously vital presentations. So we thank you, Dana. Sydney Harmon, one of the most remarkable people in the arts today, I think, having fulfilled virtually every role that can be taken from philanthropy to leadership in all kinds. We're delighted to have you. And then someone whose work and whose company's work has truly been a major shaper of the arts and supporter of the arts from Altria, Jennifer Goodale. Thank you, Jennifer. I want to start, I liked David Bradley's phrase, paving a runway. So I'd like to start paving the runway of this conversation by asking each panelist, remembering one or perhaps two of the most impressive arts leaders whose work they have known or admired, what attributes most animated those successes in the arts? And I think maybe we'll start with Sydney.
Without hesitation, sainted Beverly Sills, who you must know passed away just a few days ago. This was, without question, one of the most stunning talents in American history, and truly one of the great, great women ever. Her work as a performer for decades illuminated our lives and brought totally new insights to every operatic role that she played. It is a comment on America's views of the arts that Beverly Sills, as so many others, had to go to Europe to establish the fact that she was extraordinarily competent. Once back, she blazed new trails as a performer, and then, as you undoubtedly know, turned into one of the great executives in the world of arts at the Metropolitan Opera and at the New York City Opera. No question, we have lost a remarkable talent, and beyond anything, one of the most unimaginably courageous human beings ever I have encountered. And then, since you suggest one or two, Isaac Stern comes to mind. Magnificent talent, but in a sentence, he taught me so much about life and the world and leadership. A student once asked Isaac Stern, how can it be there must be 10,000 violinists who play every note perfectly, yet there's a mere handful of maestros? Stern replied, my son, it is not how we play the notes, it's what we do in the intervals.
Excellent. Let's go to Michael.
There are two people I'd like to at least recognize who I think were really important leaders in the arts. And of course, I think also it touched me very deeply. And that's John Houseman and Joseph Papp. A lot of you know John Houseman from his last part of his career, where he did the Smith Barney commercials. But John was an immigrant, came here from Argentina as a young man, not with an arts background of any kind, but with a huge enthusiasm for talent. I think he knew himself that he was an extremely smart and actually a good businessman, but I think what he had was a huge appetite and adoration and understanding of someone else's talent. And very early, luckily for a lot of us, early in his career, he met Orson Welles, a genius, a difficult man, and a genius. And luckily, that was the beginning of an affection that John continued for the rest of his life as he continued to support young talent, difficult, brilliant people. And during his life, he led many organizations. So it wasn't just that he helped create the Mercury Theater, but he also created the Center Theater Group in Los Angeles that still exists. He created the Juilliard School along with Michel Saint-Denis, which was probably, when it started 37 years ago, the only school really devoted to creating American actors who could act both in classical and modern works. And I think it was a school that helped, it came as a result of the burgeoning regional theater movement, but I think it's also helped create generations of actors who've been able to fill the roles in the theaters that are in many of your communities. And he continued to do this with huge enthusiasm until the day he died. I used to say, and Sidney Harmon is the other person who I admire, with the kind of energy, the ability to keep going all the time with enthusiasm, energy, clarity. And in a way, it's been a huge role model to me, but a huge role model to, I'd say, hundreds of young artists whose career he started. Joseph Papp, who I guess I owe, in a way, part of my career to, was a real visionary. Again, an immigrant, not a rich man, as a matter of fact, absolutely not a rich man, who thought that theater belonged, and classical theater, and Shakespeare particularly, belonged to the people, because he wrote for the people, about the people. And it was not an elite art. It was an American, and it needed to be done in an American way, with American actors, American artists, for a large and completely diverse American audience. And I think that Joe introduced diversity on stage in terms of casting, diversity off stage in terms of who he hired as directors and scene designers, who he hired as administrators. And of course, he instituted Free Shakespeare. Free Shakespeare, in this case, in Central Park. And because of that, I think so many of you have Free Shakespeare festivals in your communities. And I think it's probably single-handedly due to Joe Papp that Shakespeare is still alive and well in the United States of America. And again, he was a man who, while he himself, and he would probably be very angry if I say this, but he kind of told the truth all the time, and wasn't always pleasant, so I'm going to say this too, was that he wasn't a great director. As a matter of fact, he was a kind of, I suppose, frustrated director because he kept wanting to direct, and he wasn't quite as good as everybody else. But in spite of that, as usually when there are a lot of people who are directors and they're not very good and they run theaters, they tend to hire people less good than themselves all over the place, so they will look better. And one of the things I can say for Joe is that every good American director in working today probably got their first or second start with Joe. I did. He hired me. He didn't know who I was. And he hired me. And there were times I thought he hired me because he thought maybe I wouldn't be very good. But, you know, and I wondered about that sometimes. But the truth is that I would not be sitting here today if he hadn't taken a chance on somebody who he saw a 20-minute play by a young avant-garde playwright, Adrian Kennedy, and gave a major production of Shakespeare too, because he thought maybe I might have something to say. So these two people I salute completely for their, first of all, their ability to create institutions, but also for their ability to actually recognize and sustain talent. And I think that's, of course, what arts leaders should do today.
Dana.
My wife and I came to New York in 1977. We were married then, but we were going out, and we were there for 20 years. And during that time, I had a kind of unappeasable hunger for art. We went to museums, symphonies, operas, ballet, modern dance, all kinds of theater. And there were two institutions during that time who struck me as operating at the absolute upper end of execution, of just genius. One of them we've talked about a lot today, which is the New York City Ballet. There's probably never been a dance company as good as the New York City Ballet was, you know, during that period. And but I don't think it's by sheer happenstance that the greatest choreographer who ever lived, maybe the greatest American choreographer who ever lived, the greatest dancers on the planet had a well-funded theater in the middle of Lincoln Center. It was a guy named Lincoln Kirstein. And he seems to me as an arts administrator, you know, I'm a poet, but at the moment I'm an arts administrator, he strikes me as the absolute gold standard of arts administrators. And the reason is, this is a guy who, you probably could not have a more opinionated guy than Kirstein was.
Scary.
Yeah, I mean, he had an opinion on everything and forcefully, you know, enunciated, but he understood that his role was not to put what Lincoln Kirstein wanted on stage, but to take genius and clear the way. And he, Balanchine, you know, I think could never have accomplished, you know, a fraction of what he did without this fellow. And I, when I came to the endowment, I took a kind of doctor's oath. It seemed to me the first thing I had to remember is first do no harm. And I think it is, you see a lot of arts administrators, a lot of foundations that I think try to impose their agenda on arts groups. And what happens is you get a kind of a mix, you know, and you don't get the best, you know, the best of the arts or the best of whatever that agenda is. And, you know, our job as arts administrators is to clear the way for artists. And I think Kirstein is a remarkable guy in this way. The other best institution, better than, I think, at that era, the Metropolitan Opera and God knows everything else, was a company you've never heard of, and it doesn't really exist in the same way right now, called the Ridiculous Theater Company. It performed in the shabbiest, smelliest basement in New York, in Sheridan Square. The scenery and the costumes were not even at the level, you know, of the church, you know, pilgrim's pageant. It was run by a fellow named Charles Ludlam, who wrote, directed, produced, and starred in the plays. These are plays whose very names, to me, reek of greatness. Eunuchs of the Forbidden City, When Queens Collide, Irma Vep, The Bourgeois Avant-Garde. And then he would do productions of classic plays like Camille, in which he played Camille in drag, and Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, these things were about as deep into gay humor as you could possibly be. But I could, and in fact did, bring my mother, who was more Catholic than the Pope, to them. And they were so incredibly tasteful, you know, as to be something out of Molière, you know, or, you know, let's say, you know, Noel Coward or something like this. Everything was perfect. And it showed me that a real artist with no resources, with no support, could, in a sense, create something of perfection by just the charisma of genius. You would all know who Charles Ludlam, you know, was today, because just as he was being discovered, just as he went into his first movie, just as the Santa Fe Opera brought him out, he died suddenly of AIDS. But, you know, Ludlam is an inspiration to me too, because it shows that you could take the most unlikely material and out of it create, in his case, perfect farce. When he died, the company continued. It didn't seem to me to ever operate at the same level. It began to be cruder and more broad. But, you know, it's an inspiration because it's not just wealth, social position, or anything else that creates art. It's genius.
Just for a second, I also think he had a huge influence on theatrical styles for so many other artists and theaters of how he saw how art could be produced. I think it was very important. It's amazing that you brought it up. I think that's really cool.
Well, he should be. He's also, by the way, I never realized this until 10, 15 years after his death, he was a superb writer.
Yeah.
He did a book on theater, which seems to me one of the best books I've ever read on theater.
And Jennifer?
Two people come to mind, and actually one of them was Joseph Papp. and for all the reasons you say, but also the idea of access for the arts for all, which I think is such an important issue today and something that is forgotten about, and it's something that we must fight for. And second of all, the second person that came to mind was Harvey Lichtenstein, and what this man has done in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. His vision, his ability to take risks with artists from all over the world who'd never performed in this country, dance companies like Pina Bausch, Peter Sellers, the Mahabharata. He did things that no one had done before, and no one was that enthusiastic about, mind you. He's also been able to use the arts, and it's such a great example of how the arts can be a catalyst for community revitalization. And if you look at that area in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, it's transformed what's happening there. And it's because, I think, due to Harvey and a great partner he had in crime, Karen Brooks Hopkins, but I do think they took risk.
It's very interesting to me that we've heard a list mostly of practitioners, and practitioners who've risen into leadership positions by virtue of what I might call a talent for enjoyment, people who embodied the pleasure of making art and who loved finding that in others, so who listened, who admired, who mentored others. That's certainly the way we all remember Beverly Sills and Stern and Hausman, Ludlum, Joseph Papp. And then the great impresarios. We have a pair of them. People who stand in the wings, but also typically with intense opinion and yet generosity. I thought we would do a quick round for any of our panelists who had something prepared or something in advance with respect to our question about the arts today. Who shapes them? Who leads them? Who will rescue them if they are in need of rescue? And I'm going to look at Sydney because Sydney always has something to say.
Can you imagine that any one of us didn't have something to say? In our introduction, reference was made to John Kennedy's reverence for the work of and the poet himself, Robert Frost. Robert Frost once famously observed that the human mind is an astonishing instrument. It turns on automatically when we get out of bed in the morning, and it does not turn off until we get to the office. I am absolutely committed to undoing that mindless view of the arts held by most of industry. There is an exception here and there. And I am committed to doing it, not simply because I love the arts and not simply because they have enriched my life, but because I'm absolutely committed then that when the arts are integral to a well-lived life or a well-conducted business, each of them will flourish. Because of that conviction and that commitment, I here sponsored, with the support of Michael Eisner, the relatively new arts program at the Institute that has two coordinates, but I'll speak only of the first, our artists in residence. The idea there was to first go back to the roots of the Institute. This place was founded over a half a century ago by the Pepke family of Chicago, an enormously powerful industrial family, the Container Corporation of America, that largely inspired and gave life to what I regard as the unique American visual art form, poster art. They came here to an essentially abandoned old mining town to set up a commemorative for Goethe, the colossal polymath. and much of his work, Faustus and others, was recited, and much of the music that engaged his life. This combination was really the birth of the Aspen Institute. And over the years, though this institute has done all manner of wonderful stuff, somehow the arts kind of got lost. And the purpose of introducing this artist in residence program is to bring that quite remarkable mind that characterizes every artist in every expression of the arts. And I think of poets in this respect as our original systems thinkers. A systems thinker sits to my right. These people look at our universe and they interpret it to us in a fashion that no business person really ever understood. And if, in fact, that kind of thinking can be introduced to the way in which we do business, I have no doubt it will be more creative, it will be more human-centered, and in the end, as a consequence of that, more prosperous. Damian Wurzel may not know this, but next year he's going to be our artist in residence.
Could I respond to that a little bit? Because I couldn't agree with you more. And one of our company's missions is to try and encourage other companies to support the arts. And it's very frustrating, though, because I think the reality is, and when you ask the question, are the arts in crisis? I think in this country, the arts are always in crisis. I think, and it's frustrating because I read reports saying that everything's doing well and the arts are doing well. But the groups that we work with, and I see visual, performing, dance, theater, they're always struggling. And they're always competing against the social service issues and the environmental issues. Not to say that those are not important, because of course they are. And we've been hearing about it at this festival for this whole week. But how do we educate not only businesses, but the people of this of America that the arts are integral to their lives? And you have to pay for them in some ways. And even Reverend Butts was here. I don't know if you heard him speak, and he was talking about what he's done up in Harlem. And he himself, and it was so exciting, said, you can have this business and that, but without the arts, it's nothing. And that's what we got to change. We got to make that happen.
Well, you ask how we can do it, and I quickly suggest that for good or bad, industry is a tremendously powerful factor in our society. I'd be very happy to join you in affecting that in industry. I'll let others take care of the rest of our society.
Okay. Let's do it.
It's probably not exactly, but I've been here for 3 days now, or 4 days, and I've listened to a huge amount of really extraordinary panels, really, and I've gone to no arts panels. I've gone to the environment. I've gone to Iraq. I've gone to new media, and I've gone to panel after panel that has simply described sort of disastrous situations in the world that require huge solutions. But what I understood, and President Clinton said that today when he talked about interconnectedness, that I kept getting struck that somehow, even though this is simplistic, it actually comes down to the will of a single person to actually want to change something, and want to change something for something that is larger than themselves. In some way that, while you have your own self-interest of whatever it is, that to make a difference, you have to have a care and the knowledge of and an understanding, first of all, how it connects to you, but of something larger than your own narrow self-interest. Well, and what can help you learn about that more than the arts? And where can you learn about it better, but as a young person? And while we talk hugely about the need to support all of the existing performing arts institutions, I feel that it is, and I say this as someone who needs funding every minute of the time, that we have to spend a lot of energy in discussing how can arts be presented and provided for young people. And there are all the surveys you know about how it makes them think better, how it makes them read better, how it makes them understand better, how it makes them be better socialized human beings. And where are the leaders of tomorrow going to come from? They are going to come from people who have an experience of how art has somehow made some difference to them as a child. I think everybody here could talk about some early experience in their life which changed them in some indelible way. And that experience is going to come from having listened to a piece of music, heard your mother read you something from the text, having gone to a film that moved you, having whatever. And it's going to be one of the things that moved you more than anything else. And those experiences are being taken away more and more and more. And I would like to see you too also see what you know, I know data, we talk about it, we all talk about it all the time, which is how can we reintroduce art into young people's lives, where in many cases, it is simply not there.
And may I just quickly add, how can we encourage the creation of new works of art in each of the media?
Right.
Because in the absence of that, bankruptcy is inevitable.
Well, I want to build on what Michael was saying. Economic terms, the problem in American arts culture right now is not supply, it's demand. If we doubled the budget of every performing arts group in the United States, a few years later we would be in the same situation that we're in right now. And why is the demand not there to the degree that it should be? Because it's being crowded out by lots of other things. Marcus Aurelius was quoted earlier today. I think Damien quoted him. One thing Marcus Aurelius said is that the path of wisdom is taking your baser appetites and training them constantly on something nobler and nobler, to go from very simple, crude pleasures to very sophisticated and deeper pleasures. You do that through education. We have an educational system which is lopsided. We're trying to educate kids' minds, but you have to educate their emotions. You have to educate the completeness of their humanity. And you don't do that as effectively anywhere as through art. I'm interested in very basic concepts, which I don't think are well understood. We have ways of communicating. The way that the Aspen Festival communicates is in conceptual language. We sit and we talk about things in abstract language, and we're all very well trained in that. Occasionally you get somebody who's actually going into scientific language, and there's a very small group of people that could understand that. But there's another language, another way of seeing the world, understanding the world, and communicating the world, which for lack of a better word, we'll call poetry, which is to say, we don't understand it conceptually, scientifically, mathematically. We understand it intuitively, physically, imaginatively, emotionally. We understand it with the fullness of our humanity, and we communicate it that way. We communicate it through movement, through image, through story, through song. And I would say two things. First of all, this language is as irreplaceable and profound as the language of science or the language of philosophy, conceptual thought. And there are some irreplaceable truths about human existence that can only be communicated, preserved through this type of poesis. There are some truths about our existence that we can only tell each other as stories. In fact, there are some that are so embarrassing and so ridiculous we can only tell each other as jokes. You can't really communicate them anyway. Images, the same way. There's some things that movement immediately communicate. And in a way that's interesting, they communicated across languages, right, across cultures. If we educate our kids, if we develop ourselves as adults, I think, without developing and recognizing that, we're really in one corner of our human potential. And I don't think that we educate people into the largest and most powerful part of their humanity without doing this. There's a lot of other things I could say, but let me just cut it off here, because otherwise it'll become very garrulous.
I wanted to say something that struck me just, you know, aside from what Reverend Butz said today, and by the way, Reverend Butz's entire performance was a theatrical performance, based really on the church and storytelling, right, and that performance was as basic as the first theater ever set in a small community. I mean, and he was drawing on a very rich tradition of theater. He also said that, you know, you learn to get along with your wife by dancing, and just think about what it's like if two nations could dance together. But the other day, I was at one of the environmental things, and Carol Browner said that the picture of the polar bear all by himself floating on the iceberg that was torn away in water was more vivid and made more people understand global warming than even Al Gore's film. Now, that is an artistic image. It is a chosen image by an artist, a photographer, cropped in such a way. And we look at it aesthetically, but it moves us. And
because we respond to it not as an idea, but as a reality.
As a reality, but it is I think when the Reverend Butz went through that very long thing about the birth of his baby, you know, it was long. It was a way to get to the idea of birthing a new idea, pushing and birthing a new idea. And he couldn't have, if he hadn't done that story and just said, you know, we all have to push to birth a new world, we wouldn't have gotten it. He had to use language. He had to use imagery. He had to use jokes to get us to come to some understanding of a much larger thing. That's art. That is the use of art. That's the use of poetry. That's the use of language. And I'm sorry, yeah, I'll leave it at that too.
Let's return to Sydney and Jennifer's thoughts, linking them to who is shaping the arts today. And I'd just like to throw out a question about philanthropy. We have distinguished representatives of corporate, of personal, and of government support here. One idea, and I've encountered this in many, many artists and companies, is someone should write a check and then go away. But it occurs to me, especially with the stories that we opened with, that maybe the arts are best served by an intensely engaged and very personally committed philanthropy. People with real and particular taste. Certainly the Pepkes were that way. Certainly Lincoln Kirstein was that way. Much as he gave free rein to Balanchine, he also was a person of constant opinion.
He was the one who identified Balanchine.
Yes.
But Lincoln Kirstein raised a lot of money beside himself to keep, and so did Harvey. I mean, Harvey put his emotional and physical resources and then went out and raised a lot of money for them.
So just what are your thoughts about who is shaping the direction of the arts, and especially through support?
Well, I don't think I'll respond in terms of who is beyond commenting on something that Michael and I are engaged in Washington. There on October 1st, the new Center for Performing Arts will open. It will incorporate the now famed and properly famed Shakespeare Theater. It will have two theaters. Jane Harmon and I have endowed this project, but it really is something we have done to give life to this man's vision. And that vision says Shakespeare is glorious, Molière is irreplaceable, but there are literally hundreds in that small community of wonderful, aspiring, and inadequately fueled arts programs
we need to open this theater and its resources too. And so the point of the new center is not simply to give currency to the established classics, but to encourage new art expressions in dance, in music, in recitation, and of course in classic theater.
And speaking from a corporate perspective, what we're seeing now is companies coming in for short-term commitments. They want the 1-2 year splash for a particular program, and then they go away. And that's a problem, I think. I give you an example of City Center. Arlene Schuler created a program called Fall for Dance, which was a 10-day program with 5 or 6 dance companies on the roster each night. And the great thing about it was that it was $10 tickets. Took a huge risk, got some great funding from some great companies, including the company I work for, and it took off. It got new audiences in, it got the small companies, new patrons, people came to Midtown, the audiences were diverse. It was so successful. She had a vision, and she followed it, and it was great programming. Now, after 2 years, Altria is changing, we're going away, we may not be around next year. She can't get funding for it. Companies are changing their strategy. We've got to do something new. Well, Arlene's program is 2 years old and is not new anymore, so sorry, you can't come back to us. And this is so unfair and so frustrating, so it's a challenge. She can't get it endowed. And yet, this was this wonderful program that was bringing arts to everyone. So I think that we need to get companies, it just goes back to the mantra, to understand the value of the arts, to make that long-term commitment, and to be collaborative. And that's the other thing. I think foundations, individuals, and companies all have to say, let's do this together. We've heard that mantra here on every aspect. We can't do it alone, and one bank can't just take ownership of everything. We've all got to do it together. So,
you know, I don't think we're in a period right now that generally the funders are shaping the arts. If you go back into the 50s and 60s and you look at what the Ford Foundation did or what the National Endowment for the Arts did, I mean, they essentially changed American culture by their interventions. Probably the NEA is the one place that's doing this in a very few areas because of our national initiatives in jazz or Shakespeare or reading. But by and large, I don't see that as the decisive force right now. I do see in certain communities an individual coming in and just saying, you know, I've done very well in my life and I'm going to give a substantial, you know, portion of my estate to create something that seems to be individual driven. And the arts have always relied on individual patrons. But you know, the most interesting thing I see is occasionally a municipality, usually meaning a mayor, will understand that they want the arts in their city, sometimes for purely selfish reasons. They happen to like this, or they just think it's a good economic program. The most interesting one is Joe Riley, who's the mayor of Charleston, South Carolina. And I don't know, have anybody been to the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina? Well, you've seen it. I mean, if you went to Charleston 30 years ago, it was a blighted community with a great architectural legacy. Now, it is probably the most interesting city in the American South. And that's been done largely because of the Spoleto Festival, the Little Spoleto Festival, and Joe Riley, who's been mayor during all of those decades. And that's the kind of thing where somebody understands that this is part of the civic life that they want to create, and it creates employment, it creates all kinds of investment. I mean, you can eat better in Charleston, South Carolina, you know, today within about a 5-block area than you probably could have in a tri-state area, you know, 30 years ago. And it's been all driven by arts. I want to say one other thing. The single most interesting arts project I see anywhere in the United States right now is this thing that Michael Tilson Thomas has done with the New World Symphony outside of Miami. First, the whole idea of the New World Symphony is a brilliant idea to take young musicians, give them a few-year fellowship in an orchestra. They are building a symphony hall that is actually not much bigger than this auditorium here, maybe about 2.5 times as big. Doesn't seat that many people. It's see what those guys are standing back with the cameras. He's got an incredible video and audio system. It's in the middle of a park, this new hall, and they have one enormous flat wall on one side of the building that goes into the park. Every performance in this hall will be under ideal conditions for the audience, but will then be broadcast simultaneously outside with superb sound and sight and free to the community. This park will be, I think, the most widely visited place in Miami. And they'll, in a sense, have done something that presenters have been trying to do for ages, to present things to the world, to make them open, without in the least compromising the artistic quality of the performance and the experience.
Dan, do you happen to know the source of that superb sound?
I should have guessed. You know, but it's largely been paid for by, you know, one individual in terms of. But I think that this is something we're going to see all over the country. It's something that's truly innovative, because the question is, and this is what I deal with at the endowment, how do you bring the best artistic experience possible to the most people possible and be true both to art and to democracy?
Well, I'd add that MTT and his team at New World have been pioneers in Internet too. And distance learning applications in music. They have solved problems that people said could not be solved.
But let me say this, and this is not taking anything away. I don't worry about the internet. I really don't. It's going to do real well. What I worry about is American civic life. That's what's the notion of citizenship, of a shared public space, of belonging to a community, the vision of the Commonwealth. That is in danger in our country. And that's what I love about this program. It invests in the Commonwealth of Miami.
Could I just because I totally agree with bringing the best of art to the most people possible, but there's also that other side, and I know you agree with this, of those artists who are experimenting and exploring and doing things that aren't that popular, and there's got to be room for those artists to do that. And I think that's also a challenge for them, to have artists who need to develop work, to have the time, the space, the resources, just as the Institute does for Anna Divya Smith. What a gift that is. But that is a huge problem that is way underfunded and needs to be addressed.
Well, and that is that follows on what Damian Wetzel was saying in the previous session, I think. In creating a pathway to high art, is our goal to have the largest audience possible, or is there a competing goal of refining the art itself and revitalizing that?
So when I talk about the largest audience possible, I'm talking about if you think the full audience for the full range of offerings. I do believe the bigger the tent, the more room there is for experimentation and diversity in that tent. If you bring in 100 million theater goers, I think ideally you'll create a more interesting and varied experience than you will if you bring in 100,000.
And I'll just quarrel with the premise of the question. I don't think they're in competition at all. I think they're mutually reflexive.
I think that there is a danger now. I mean, also of artistic organizations pricing themselves out of their audience, and that's a real. That's a really serious problem for a lot of us. And it's one that we struggle with all the time, because, and I don't think we're here to talk about our own particular stories, but I do know that I have total evidence of a huge audience for the kind of work we do, which we're not doing other than the best work we know how to do, if we can make it affordable enough. And of course, when 4,000 people a night come to a difficult play by Shakespeare because it's free, and respond the same way as people who are paying $65 during the week at a smaller house, the work is the work. It's the access to it that is difficult. And we all struggle we all struggle with how can we make the work both better but also more accessible. And I think what you're talking about, that Michael's doing, is has a great deal to do with access. And access is a large issue. And the leaders in the arts of tomorrow should think that access is a serious, serious thing that they should be providing so that the audience of tomorrow is actually there.
I mean, how many of us have gone to a spectacular play, concert, exhibition, you know, a dance performance in a place that was half empty? I mean, that's the universal experience that we're trying to talk about. But, you know, this country, thank God, has a consensus that education should be free and universally accessible. I think all we have to do is to broaden that consensus into saying that the arts must play a role in that education. If we do that, I think it will, you know, develop better citizens, first of all.
That's for sure.
But also the next generation of artists, of audiences, and patrons. And the funny thing is that nobody really disagrees with that until they get on a school board, until they become a mayor, until they, you know, get elected to be an educational commissioner. And then it's treated as a luxury. And you know, we've got an educational system in this country which now is focused at producing entry-level workers, you know, for low-level jobs. And this is not the way this country is going to prosper in this century. And I don't advocate the arts in education because I want to produce more painters and poets and writers. That'll happen as a byproduct. I advocate it because I don't see any other way in which we're going to realize the potential of the next generation, if nothing else, to keep 30% of them from dropping out.
So let me say that I think that everybody in this room and all of us have a very large responsibility. I think every art, we can't sit around and complain much longer about the educational system in many of our cities. There are a lot of things that are needed to fix the educational system in our cities. I live in one in which the education system is pretty much broken. In Washington, D.C., it's a shame, the most powerful city on earth with one of the worst educational systems, public educational system. But it is our responsibility now as artists to find a way to make up for the deficiencies in that system. And I think it's the responsibility of every single artistic institution in an urban area or rural area to make part of its mission and its time to work with young people. And not to work with them on, I'm coming in like a star and talking to you and you'll all be very excited and you get my, autograph, even though you don't know who the hell I am. But actually to go in there and devote a certain amount of time, thoughtful program to actually introduce art into the schools. And I think all of you have an equal responsibility, which is to take kids to arts programs. Yes. And there are a lot of parents who don't do that. If you're a parent, take your child and take four other kids whose parents don't have the time. And if you're a grandparent and you have a lot of time, take them a lot.
Well, I went to a matinee at the Met of Julie Taymor's Magic Flute. It was Saturday matinee. Every seat was sold. There probably were not more than 40 kids in the audience. I mean, I can't see, forget grandpa, bring the kid. I don't see why those people weren't taking their children and their grandchildren there. I mean, it just struck me. These were people of enormous affluence. I mean, this wasn't a matter of economics. It was, a failure of imagination.
I think we have to have we're so good at marketing. We are so good at marketing things that we don't need. And why doesn't some fantastic corporation decide to market the need to attend the arts? It has happened sometimes.
Very interesting, but I think that...
And let the parents be the leaders, the artistic leaders of today as they introduce young people to the arts.
It's the parents who aren't really doing... I mean, they're not advocating for the arts with their politicians, with their... let me go back here. First of all, I think that the arts... there's so much competition for what kids can be doing now, And people have such a short attention span. The idea of taking kids to sit for 2.5-3 hours in the Met is a challenge for parents.
For the parents, not for the kids.
Correct. But that's the problem. It's the parents who have got to start changing. And it's sometimes if you say, oh, I support the arts, I don't think that's necessarily, you're not looked at with great, oh, good for you. If you stand up there and you say, well, I'm green and I've got all these right light bulbs, oh, right. I mean, there's this competition or this that is about the value of the arts in our society. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. And in fact, we wrote a list of 10 things you can do to help support the arts. One of them is that. One of them is talk to your congressman. One of them is tell your neighbor how much you love the arts. Let's talk about it. Let's, you know, live it.
And Michael, I would say that however we market it, let's make damn sure that we don't market it and therefore trivialize it as decoration. Make certain that it is understood that this and mother's milk are foundation.
But see, I think your point is very central, is that we live in a society that isn't driven by ideas. It really isn't. It's driven by personalities. And I think that's part of the electronic reality that we're in. And of the thousands of personalities that we see in the media, there's virtually no artists in the sense that we're talking about present. You know, Beverly Sills' death reminds us that we don't have an American opera singer who's famous now in the way that Richard Tucker was famous, Beverly Sills was famous, Anna Mofo was famous, Jan Pierce was famous, Caruso or Mario Lanza was famous. And what we need, and this is something that we need to, in order to change behavior, we need to change the conversation that our country has about itself, which is what we call the media. And when you don't have artists who are capable, in a sense, of talking to a broad, mixed audience about why these things are important, they can't do it compellingly or amusingly or with attitude or with whatever part of the ecosystem this personality is in, they become marginal, they become inaudible and invisible in our culture. Mm-hmm. Our artists are wonderfully expert at talking to one another. They've lost, for the most part, the ability to sit there and charm. And I use charm in the root sense of the word, cast a magic spell on an audience to make them feel the importance of what they're doing. And the two or three that we have that are left, I mean, a Yo-Yo Ma, are enormously important, but we should have hundreds.
But we do have more than Yo-Yo Ma, and we have Wynton Marsalis. And here at Aspen, we have Jesse Norman, who does that superbly. And did here just the other day, left the group visiting with her, nothing less than transported.
But I had wanted to say this when you said what were the things we were thinking of when we came here. I think it's the responsibility of art schools now, drama schools, music schools, painting schools, to actually institute in their curriculum the idea that of artist as citizen, not just artist as artist, but artist whose actual purpose, part of your purpose, is to make a better society, to actually affect your society in some way. And one of them is to go out into the society and to learn how to be able to communicate what Damon said, what Dana is saying people aren't doing. That's sometimes easy. It's easy for us up here. We're kind of maybe good at it. There are people who need to have the opportunity to see, one, it's important, and two, learn how to do it. And I think it should be part of every artist training nowadays.
And I want to mention that Jesse Norman, when she came to the music festival and spoke to voice students, and she asked that they be only voice students and no public, they thought they were going to get excellent career advice and find out about their Fach and what roles they should be singing and how not to push and et cetera. Instead, she spoke about volunteering in their communities. And she said it is so crucial that as musicians you be citizens. And then at the right moment, when you're delivering Meals on Wheels, you say, and I am a singer. But so that the public understands artists as members of the public. With that, shall we open up to thoughts, comments, questions? Yes.
I want to poke a little bit more, Ron Schiller, at this question of supply and demand. Because I think I heard two somewhat different things. Michael, you mentioned if we could open the doors, you'd have 4,000 people coming into the theater. and my apartment in Chicago looks out on Grant Park. There's a concert there, and there are 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 people. So there's this tremendous demand, and I think a number of us have seen this in a lot of different arts organizations. The Art Institute of Chicago opening for free one night a week, and so on and so forth, with just people streaming in. And then there's the question of the half-empty concert hall, or the half-empty whatever it might be, where we're selling tickets, and we also talked a little bit about the price of tickets going up. So I wonder, a number of years ago, before I was born, I think, people worried. If we have recordings, no one will come to the concert hall. In fact, it proved to be, most people would say, the opposite. Recordings sent music out to a larger audience, which created, stimulated more of an audience. Now we have Peter Gelb taking the bold move of saying, we're just going to put the Metropolitan Opera out for free for tens of thousands of people. And we have all of these other examples of delivering it. I think a lot of arts organizations have been afraid that if we make this accessible, if we make this free, or if we build a wall and show the concert to all of Miami, that no one will come pay for the concert hall. When we also know that it's the gray audience, that in fact has always been gray, that has disposable income and disposable time, or discretionary time, in order to be able to fill the concert halls. So I just wanted to poke a little bit more at this question of supply and demand. Is it that we don't have enough demand, or is there something...
Well, can I get technical on this? Because, you know, I, for better or worse, I actually know statistics.
Yeah.
One of the things the NEA does, which is very valuable, is we measure attendance, we measure participation. The arts are somewhat different. And if you look at the arts, the visual arts in terms of museums are doing quite well. These free public performances, I think, are doing well. And I think one of the reasons is that our civic life has shrunk down so that there are so few civic events that people can bring families to, you know, young lovers can go off together to, and things like this. And it's a different, almost experiential, behavioral gap that those things fill. But if you look at the traditional arts, which is how do you get people in the theater to buy a ticket, curiously, what is the healthiest art form in the United States? Opera, the most expensive. We're in a society where people will pay $250 to get Red Sox tickets, where a rock concert plus the program, you know, it could be over $100 for a person. Poor people, you know, spend hundreds of dollars for a pair of shoes. What people want, price does not seem to be a major object. The problem is, I think, is that when we develop what I would think of as sophisticated art forms, and I mean that in the best sense, art forms which require a great sensitivity to language, to sound, to movement. Think of just three examples: spoken theater, symphonic music or chamber music, and dance. Those, the attendance is dropping off. And I think it's because two things. We don't have these very powerful spokespeople in society sort of saying, gee, you know, Beverly Sills runs the Tonight Show, for a week. Millions of people, they sort of see it. They see an opera singer. It demystifies it. It enchants it. And they aren't being given the little steps in education. You know, you see a play, you read a play, you begin to develop your sensitivities of language. So what we're left with is an older audience and those younger people who either want to be artists and so have immersed themselves or almost voluntarily, independently have trained themselves. And I think that I look on theater, for example, is something that, if you look at it historically, comes out of free society. It's a civic space where stories are acted out that dramatize the issues that a society faces, be it Athens, Elizabethan England, or 20th century America. And those are the things that are endangered, and it is demand. I really do think it is demand. There's wonderful performances. I mean, has there ever been a period in history that we have as many good classical musicians as the United States has today? I mean, it's unprecedented. There are, depending on how you count it, around 1,100 to 1,200 professional orchestras in the United States. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there's now over 200 opera companies. And so we've created the previous, but one chairman, Bill Ivey, has written a whole thing of he thinks that American arts are, he has a wonderfully odd term, overcapitalized, too much infrastructure. And he may be right in some sense, but the fact is that those communities need theaters, they need orchestras. And there is, I think there is a demand if we could in a sense awaken the appetites. You know, but it is a question of I think it goes back to what Marcus Aurelius said, how do we refine, expand, deepen, taste?
Well, I think it has, again, and it goes back to what I said earlier, I think we've lost something close to a generation, and I think if we don't do something about it now in the schools, we'll have lost two generations, and not only will we lost a generation, we'll have lost the parents of the next generation and the teachers of the next generation who have never had any experience of art in their lives, and therefore why in God's name should they encourage it to anybody else? So I think it's our responsibility to do something about that right now.
And I think you're right. The most important thing we can do is model personal behavior. Take your kids, take your grandkids. I mean, for reading, the single most important thing that determines whether an adult reads is whether, one, their parents or grandparents read to them as a child, and the second one is far more interesting, whether they saw their parents read. Their parents said, "Get the hell out of here, I'm reading a book." That's as good as reading to your kids. So it's, because they actually see it as behavior.
Yeah, I'd like to give everybody in America a rebate if you take kids to something. That would be nice.
Let's have another question. Yes.
I'm Jimmy Reese from New Orleans, or what used to be New Orleans. You mentioned the National Endowment for the Arts funding back in the 1960s. Could you compare that to the funding today? And what impact would additional NEA funding have on both the marketing of art forms and the educational aspect in our public schools?
Okay. Well, but let me say this with a disclaimer, and I say this as a member of the federal government. The federal government can spend money wisely or stupidly, and so sometimes more funding won't do any good. But assuming that the money is spent wisely, here is the history. The NEA is 41 years old. During the first few years, it was created in the Great Society period by Lyndon Baines Johnson. It was really a committee that had a few million dollars that they gave premier organizations, large grants. New York Ballet gets $100,000, American Ballet gets $200,000, Chicago Lyric Opera gets $100,000. And then, curiously, the person who built the NEA was Richard Nixon, who looked on it as a way of bringing people together during a divisive social period. Not that we would know what a divisive social period is nowadays. And it went to about $140 million. And then it was basically did very well, under Ford, under Carter, under Reagan, under Bush 41. And it had, at that point, the high budget was about $175 million. Now, if you go back under Reagan or Carter, and you take that budget in current dollars, it's $400 million in terms of spending power. Every dollar the NEA invests in the arts tends to generate 7 to 8 additional dollars, because we have matching requirements, plus it in a sense validates an organization. I mean, if somebody comes to Altria and says, well, we've got an NEA grant, we're going to do this, Altria says, well, it must be a pretty good program because the NEA has these independent panels that does it, and it's probably really going to happen because they've got the base funding. We now have, our current budget is $125 million. We've just, I'm happy to say, had the largest annual increase in our history passed through the House, of an additional $35 million, so
which you should be congratulated for.
Well, it's many people made that happen. So it's we're really operating at about 1/3 our historical level. That being said, I think we've gotten smarter about how to spend the money. But it's
It's less.
Yeah, but it is less. I think if we had more money, we could do two things. What worries me is that in the old days, if we went to a dance group or a symphony and gave them an NEA grant, it was enough to do a whole production. It was enough to say, okay, we want to put on Rigoletto. This will pay for Rigoletto. This will pay for the development of a new ballet. Now it's just not that way. It's just really a fraction of that. I think we could make the grants more meaningful. Secondly, I think we could afford to take a leadership position in certain national issues, and this has probably been my main emphasis as chairman, there's certain issues that are national, perhaps even international, that no one organization, you know, Michael, no matter how good his theater is, cannot address because the whole culture is pressing down on him. And the NEA is, unfortunately, the only institution in the United States that has a range to be able to address these things. And if we don't deal with them, no one will. If we do it meaningfully, then the private funders, the foundations, the state arts, you know, come in. So it's our job, God help us, to lead, to, in a sense, to try to create a new consensus that can address at least some of these major issues, which are in our, both in education, in, you know, in civic life, as well as in, you know, in more traditional artistic areas.
I said a few hours ago that there were two coordinates in the new arts program at the Institute. The second is to encourage the private sector to do what NEA inadequately, in my judgment, woefully inadequately funded, cannot get done. And I'm hopeful that you'll be helpful there.
I think we have time for one more.
Glad to hear this story.
Me too, and I still, I mean, I actually think it's going to be one person at a time. In a way, it's going to be that. Well, and congratulations to your child.
If I could tell you a story, which is I was in, I'm from a town called Hawthorne, California. You can't, it really is a bad neighborhood. But there's actually a neighborhood even worse than Hawthorne next to us called Lenox. Lenox is in the congressional district of a woman named Jane Harmon. I went with her to this school in Lenox, in which the Los Angeles Philharmonic has made a partnership. And these are kids almost entirely from Mexican immigrant families. And there's a class of little boys learning the harp. Every kid in the school plays the recorder. And it was a fantastic program. I mean, you see these kids actually making music. Yeah. And so, you know, it can be done. And it was because, I mean, it took a lot of people to take this one school. Now, I only wish that this school could be replicated across Los Angeles first, you know, California second, the United States third. But there are where you get one or two remarkable principals or teachers, they can do it. But the problem is, you know, you need a system which aids those people so that it's not entirely uphill. I'll say the saddest thing that's happened, and the happiest and saddest thing that's happened in the American arts, from my perspective in this last year, was that Governor Schwarzenegger got $500 million approved for arts education in California. It was there to buy new musical equipment, musical instruments, art supplies, theatrical equipment, and then somehow as it went through the system, the educational bureaucrats got it and said, we've just made one little change. You can now use this thing to buy arts equipment or sports equipment. And it went away almost immediately. So, you know, the thing is that, you know, you've got to have that follow through. And I was, you know, and it was being so incredibly happy that this thing had happened to so saying, oh my God, it's bureaucracy as usual.
And the private sector can do its piece. 9 years ago, Winston Marsalis and I
began a program called How to Listen. We went to Philadelphia. We went to the blighted areas of cities like Philadelphia and Atlanta, areas that, in my view, would be served well if they were also in Jane Harman's district. And I would tell these kids, and they all came, I'd tell these kids stories, and Winton would introduce them in his unique way to call and recall, to harmonics, to the fundamentals of music, and he'd have them up on stage, having the time of their lives, and then would leave a music reproducing system behind us, and the parents got wise, and the parents caught on. And now that program has expanded. Others, not Winton, not I, are doing it. I think encouraging material like that collaboration with what you're doing, talking about, would be wonderful.
We've created an introduction to jazz that's free to any American teacher that they can use during Black History Month as a 5-day course. But we've run out of money for it. And we have a waiting list, you know, of thousands of teachers that when the next year's appropriations come in, we can bring out this many more. And I've already got all of next year's kits done. And we need private partners for things like that.
I'm afraid. Okay, we're out of time, but we'll go to BT and then quick wrap up.
I'd just like to pose a question on this idea of awakening an audience from the vantage point of a composer. My thought is this: is it possible that we may not be embracing the right content? And let's see. I've been sitting here stewing for a while trying to ask this question. I played at the Hollywood Bowl as a part of the Video Games Live. Help me out here. I'm actually going to sit down and ask this question. and we performed music using an orchestra for 11,000 people, where there were 14-year-olds in the audience and there were grandparents. And my question is this: is it possible that the content that's being played in these venues has to do with the diminishing attendance?
Yes. I mean, I think that what you're saying is, I think, something different. I think what you're saying is that isn't it possible that there are all kinds of entry points into these arts that we aren't making the most of? And I absolutely agree. That there's, you know, ways of getting people to actually hear a symphony orchestra for the first time. Maybe it is a Lord of the Rings concert where they actually hear the music they know from movies.
I think if you want to engage kids in the beauty and the depth of orchestral music or theater, then it's really important that that the content connects with them emotionally. And whereas when I was a kid and I was studying Debussy and, you know, Rachmaninoff, to a kid that's 14 now, to hear video game music played by a live orchestra is really engaging. And from that point of entry, as you're saying, that child can branch out and discover some of my heroes and some of the modern masters, where, you know, the amount of times you see a John Adams piece played as opposed to something that's 200 years old is pretty astonishing. I just think that there's not an emotional point of connection for young people to enjoy.
Yeah, agreeing with everything you say, I would simply add that the reason that there isn't an emotional point of connection is that these kids have not had the chance to be exposed to it, you know, through their lives, and so they're being drawn to it the few points of communication that they have, you know, which are, you know, largely from commercial, you know, entertainment, video games, movies. So I agree with everything you say, but I think we're not doing enough to provide more and more meaningful points of connection for kids. It's interesting, when you do a demographic survey of people in a symphony orchestra, it's not primarily, the audience isn't there primarily through income or education. The thing that most of them have in common, the single most important thing, is that they played an instrument
at some point in their life. Mm. And they learned about music making from the inside. That is more important than income. And I think that that's what we're trying to do, is give people experiential knowledge and love of the joy of the different arts provide.
The chicken or the egg syndrome. I was fortunate enough to have parents that, you know, had me in front of a piano, studying the piano Suzuki method when I was four, you know. But I really believe that, you know, with the lack of funding in the arts and the things that we're facing, of course we have to address those sort of things. But I think that there's really something to be said about honoring the work of modern masters as a point of connection emotionally for young audiences.
Yeah, I agree. But I would say that the Zen riddle of the chicken and egg can only be answered by you want both.
Okay, I'm going to have to step in. We have reached our time limit. I want to thank our panelists, and I especially want to thank all of you. I want to give Michael's challenge to us, the sort of Pogo paraphrase, which is, we have met the future of the arts, and it is us. So, thank you.